Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 6, Chapter 6, and it goes a little something like this. During the first weeks of his stay in Petersburg, Prince Andrew felt the whole trend of thought he had formed during his life of seclusion quite overshadowed by the trifling cares that engrossed him in that city. On returning home in the evening, he would jot down in his notebook 4 or 5 necessary calls or appointments for certain hours. The mechanism of life, the arrangement of the day so as to be in time everywhere, absorbed the greater part of his vital energy. He did nothing, did not even think or find time to think, but only talked, and talked successfully, of what he had thought while in the country. He sometimes noticed with dissatisfaction that he repeated the same remark on the same day in different circles. But he was so busy for whole days together that he had no time to notice that he was thinking of nothing. As he had done on their first meeting at Kochubey's, Speransky produced a strong impression on Prince Andrew on the Wednesday, when he received him tête-à-tête at his own house and talked to him long and confidentially. To Bolkonski, so many people appeared contemptible and insignificant creatures, and he so longed to find in someone the living ideal of that perfection towards which he had strove, that he readily believed that in Speransky he had found this ideal of a perfectly rational and virtuous man. Had Speransky sprung from the same class as himself and possessed the same breeding and traditions, Bolkonski would soon have discovered his weak, human, unheroic sides. But, as it was, Speransky's strange and logical turn of mind inspired him with respect all the more because he did not quite understand him. Moreover, Speransky, either because he appreciated the other's capacity or because he considered it necessary to win him to his side, showed off his dispassionate, calm reasonableness before Prince Andrew and flattered him with that subtle flattery which goes hand in hand with self-assurance and consists in a tacit assumption that one's companion is the only man besides oneself capable of understanding the folly of the rest of mankind and the reasonableness and profundity of one's own ideas. During their long conversation on Wednesday evening, Speransky more than once remarked, "We regard everything that is above the common level of rooted custom," or with a smile, "But we want the wolves to be fed and the sheep to be safe," or "they cannot understand this," and all in a way that seemed to say, "We, you and I, understand what they are and who we are." This first long conversation with Speransky only strengthened in Prince Andrew the feeling he had experienced towards him at their first meeting. He saw in him a remarkable, clear-thinking man of vast intellect, who by his energy and persistence had attained power, which he was using solely for the welfare of Russia. In Prince Andrew's eyes, Speransky was the man he would himself have wished to be, one who explained all the facts of life reasonably, considered important only what was rational, and was capable of applying the standard of reason to everything. Everything seemed so simple and clear in Speransky's exposition that Prince Andrew involuntarily agreed with him about everything. If he replied and argued, it was only because he wished to maintain his independence and not submit to Speransky's opinions entirely. Everything was right, and everything was as it should be. Only one thing disconcerted Prince Andrew. This was Speransky's cold, mirror-like look, which did not allow one to penetrate to his soul, and his delicate white hands, which Prince Andrew involuntarily watched as one does watch the hands of those who possess power. This mirror-like gaze and those delicate hands irritated Prince Andrew. He knew not why. He was unpleasantly struck, too, by the excessive contempt for others that he observed in Speransky, and by the diversity of lines of argument he used to support his opinions. He made use of every kind of mental device, except analogy, and passed too boldly, it seemed to Prince Andrew, from one to another. Now he would take up the position of a practical man and condemn dreamers, now that of a satirist and laugh ironically at his opponents, now grow severely logical, or suddenly rise to the realm of metaphysics. This last resource was one he very frequently employed. He would transfer a question to metaphysical heights, pass on to definitions of space, time, and thought, and, having deduced the refutation he needed, would again descend to the level of the original discussion. In general, the trait of Speransky's mentality which struck Prince Andrew most was his absolute and unshakable belief in the power and authority of reason. It was evident that the thought could never occur to him which to Prince Andrew seemed so natural, namely that it is, after all, impossible to express all one thinks, and that he had never felt the doubt. Is not all I think and believe nonsense? And it was just this peculiarity of Speransky's mind that particularly attracted Prince Andrew. During the first period of their acquaintance, Bolkonski felt a passionate admiration for him, similar to that which he had once felt for Bonaparte. The fact that Speransky was the son of a village priest, and that stupid people might meanly despise him on account of his humble origin, as in fact many did, caused Prince Andrew to cherish his sentiment for him the more, and unconsciously to strengthen it. On that first evening Bolkonski spent with him, having mentioned the commission for the revision of the Code of Laws, Speransky told him sarcastically that the commission had existed for 150 years, had cost millions, and had done nothing except that Rosenkampf had stuck labels on the corresponding paragraphs of the different codes. "And that is all the state has for the millions it has spent," said he. "We want to give the Senate new juridical powers, but we have no laws. That is why it is a sin for men like you, Prince, not to serve in these times." Prince Andrew said that for that work, an education in jurisprudence was needed, which he did not possess. "But nobody possesses it. So what would you have? It is a vicious circle from which we must break our way out." A week later, Prince Andrew was a member of the Committee on Army Regulations and, what he had not at all expected, was chairman of a section of the Committee for the Revision of Laws. At Speransky's request, he took the first part of the Civil Code that was being drawn up and, with the aid of the Code Napoleon and the Institutes of Justinian, he worked at formulating the section on personal rights. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, and Prince Andrei is all systems go, full steam ahead. He's getting up every day, he's writing lists of what he's going to do tomorrow, and he's getting up and he's checking the things off and he's making appointments, and this proposal that he really wanted to get through, well, he's done it. Not only has he done it, he's made himself the chairman of the Committee of Army Regulations. And he did that after a few setbacks from the Emperor himself and from some other person who was very high up in the rankings. These people just didn't like the look of him, or they didn't want to, you know, entertain his proposal. And he didn't lose focus and he just kept pushing, and now this Speransky guy has come along and, you know, they've hit it off and boom, his reform is passed. You got to hand it to Prince Andrei, don't you? He's really changed. He's unstoppable at the moment. The man has turned a corner and he's on a good path. But what was it last chapter when I was saying, or maybe it was a chapter before, I'm a little bit concerned by the volatility of his convictions. One day he's all in going one direction, and then the next day he sees a tree and he's all in going in another direction. And then he sees a pretty girl and he's all in going in a third direction. It's kind of like it's great while it lasts, but he's too easily swayed and too volatile. That makes me a bit uneasy. I feel like there's still a few twists and turns for Prince Andrei yet. Now, since yesterday as well, I looked up Speransky on Wikipedia. Mikhail Speransky, M-I-K-H-A-I-L. Speransky, because I said I wanted to learn a bit more about him. Now, through doing that, I kind of read sort of like spoilers, because he was a real guy. Not really spoilers, because it's just part of history, but it tells you what he does over the next few years, and it seems that a lot of the significant things that he did happen in the next few years of this novel. So it's not really worth going into the changes he makes or the things that he does, because it's going to be explained throughout the novel. But at this point of the novel, he is a close advisor to Emperor Alexander. And he's also been introduced to Napoleon. And you got to remember now that Napoleon and Alexander are all buddies, and there's been this, they're now allies between Russia and France. So Speransky's gone and been advised by Napoleon and sort of brought back some of those French Revolution ideas to Russia, namely this thing about personal rights for their serfs. He's quite powerful now in the novel, but it seems he's going to become more powerful. So Prince Andrei's made a really good friend here. Although he doesn't really seem to quite trust this new friend. He says there's something off about his eyes and his hands. Nevertheless, he does seem to agree with everything that Speransky says. Who Was Once Delight had an interesting little analysis about this chapter. Who Was Once Delight said, "I really, really sympathize with Andrei and have since the beginning, though there are aspects of his personality that I probably make too many allowances for. I'd find them hard to stomach in characters who I hadn't already developed an admiration for. For example, in this chapter it says, Prince Andrei considered such a vast number of people as contemptible and insignificant beings. This is about the most off-putting statement I could think of, as though it were specifically tailored to be a trait I personally would find unappealing, and yet I breeze by it because I'm not sure. Andrei's search for purpose and meaning is combined with action. He doesn't talk a lot about his beliefs, but he does reflect on them and act confidently and competently. He seems very self-possessed. In another character, I might say arrogant, though. In this treatment of his serfs and his refusal of special treatment due to his title, he seems genuine in, not ideals, but a sense of what is appropriate and best. He is unsentimental and doesn't seek acclaim for these things. Early in the novel, he was noted as having the look of a man who has no time to think of the impression he made on others, and who was occupied with pleasant and interesting things. As an anxious person, that description just fills me with awe and envy." It's funny to read this description. I think what's happening, potentially, is, you know, with this genre, an epic novel, you get to know a character so well that they feel very human. And when you think characters in sort of two dimensions, like in a typical fictional story, you see them as the bad guy, and this is their ugly traits, this is their redeeming qualities, but it's all very easily kind of summarized in your head, like this person's more bad than good, or vice versa. But with an epic, you get to know a character so well that you feel like they're a real person with much more depth than that. And the thing is, when you see something that you hate about a person in real life, like that thing that you said earlier, Who Was Once Delight, about that statement being so off-putting, it was as though it was specifically tailored to be a trait that you personally would find unappealing, but yet you breeze by it. It's almost like we recognize that when something really seems contemptible, you know, you see a trait in someone else and you're like, oh, that's so ugly. It's usually a bit of a mirror into what you are insecure about as your own worst trait. We're all aware of like that ugly, hideous trait that sometimes leaks out if you're not careful. We've all got them. No one's perfect unless you sort of accept that you've got these imperfections and manage them. And so when we think about real people, we kind of allow for that. And when we see an ugly trait, we can kind of recognize that we think that's ugly because we want them to be better and because we see that as a reflection of something that we might hate about ourselves. I think with a genre like epic, where you get to know a character so well, it allows that to happen. Who Was Once Delight continued on to say, "He had this recent bout of I am old and wise, and with age and wisdom I have realized that spring, love and happiness are stupid and senseless, and oh wait, no, there's a pretty girl. Let me now convince myself that it is only makes sense for me to rejoin the young and alive world I was just feeling so superior for rejecting." Even though he is 31, he is still a young adult who is figuring things out, and this seems really true to what I know of that, both in its inconsistency and its earnestness. I feel like, having written all this, that if anything, I should have just talked myself out of liking him so much, but I haven't. I'm rooting for him. I want him to find some sort of satisfaction, but I worry that his faults will get in the way of that ever happening. Yeah, I can just see, like, he's progressing, and he is maturing, and he's making the right moves, but it's kind of like this two steps forward, one steps back sort of thing. If you were to plot out his progress on a map, on a graph, it wouldn't be a straight line on an upwards trajectory. It would go up and down, and, you know, sometimes it would dip lower than it was previously, and then it might spike back up, and it's not going to be all up. But I think if you average it out, he is becoming a better and better person. I also found it funny that Who Was Once Delight referred to him as sort of being old. Even though he's 31, he is still a young adult who is figuring things out. As a 32-year-old, I can assure you that being 32 feels roughly the same as being like 17. Pretty much. Like, your body feels a bit sorer. But other than that, you still have that feeling like, oh, I'm meant to be an adult now. What would an adult do now? Maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm a slow starter. JMama8779 responded to Who Was Once Delight's analysis by saying, I was going to say a lot of things, but I'll just say ditto. Good analysis. I'm all in rooting for Andre too. Harvester of Baobab said, oh my, I adore Andre too. It started from the description of his wife. I just loved her. And he was so loving for her and everything, but also he was sad because they loved each other. They just weren't happy in this marriage. Then it got me that he's also a great person himself, not only as a husband. And then she died, and there's only Andre left. Who I sympathize with is Natasha. Maybe because I'm a girl, who knows? They should be together so much. She's brave and happy and sees more in others than a regular person, and he's depressed and intelligent. Oh, I'm waiting only for this. Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page there, Baobabs. If it wasn't for the age difference, I'd say they're a really good match. The age difference makes it a bit awkward, but then I'm also aware of the fact that this is 1809 in Russia, so maybe that's normal. 31 and 17. It's one of those moments where you're like, Tolstoy, couldn't you have just made her 25 or something? Just make the age difference a little bit less inconvenient. But hey, we'll have to wait and see what happens there. All right, that's going to do us for today. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to support the podcast, you can have a look at the Patreon page for it. It's patreon.com/AYearOfWarAndPeacePodcast, or you can find a link in the description for this episode. And you can donate an amount that you feel is equal to the value of the effort that is put into this podcast. Or, of course, you can continue to enjoy the podcast for free. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.